From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Historian Bill Malone grew up with old, familiar songs he hummed as a child in Texas. In the 1960s, he wrote a dissertation on country music, when nobody was writing dissertations about country music.
Actually, it was a graduate student who said to me one day, he said, you know, I really envy you. You're working on that topic. I'm writing on the history of the Austro-Sardinian War.
Malone devoted his life to country music. And then...
here comes Ken Burns. The great validator.
Bill Malone, of PBS country music fame, after the break.
We will lay down a burden, our staff and our rod. At the end of the journey is God.
Oh, no.
Bill Malone grew up in East Texas in the 1930s, listening to the songs his mother sang on the family's cotton farm, as well as songs in church and on the radio. Over the years, he kept listening to Southern music, songs playing on jukeboxes, at honky-tonks, in concert halls, and at university, in Texas and beyond. He also was playing and singing with friends who were equally passionate about Southern vernacular music. What exactly Malone heard in the songs was a subject he wrote and wrote and wrote about as a PhD student in history at the University of Texas at Austin, and then in a book called Country Music USA, which became the book on country music, unrivaled in academia. Malone's lifelong scholarship and subsequent books tell a broader story of millions of working-class Americans who for centuries have negotiated a changing social, economic, technological, and geographic landscape. Malone retired from Tulane University's history department in 1995, but he's never been more famous than he is now. As a celebrated scholar, as host of the radio program Back to the Country on WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, and as the resident historian in the recent Ken Burns PBS series on country music. Bill Malone joins us at Oak Street Studios. Welcome.
Oh, glad to be here. Good to be back home.
It's very nice to see you.
I was here 25 years, and so I still have good memories of those days, and some of my best friends live here. So it was just a good period.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I guess we should mention that I was one of your students when you were at Tulane.
Yeah.
Not one of your best students, I should add. But definitely one of your most interested ones.
Well, there's only one Gwen Tompkins.
Oh, my gosh. And so when you cast your mind back to childhood, you know, why do you suppose music seized you in the way that it did?
Well, it may have been because of where we lived. We weren't totally isolated by any means, but growing up there at the end of the 1930s, it was very much like it would have been, say, in the 1830s. We had no electricity, no running water, no automobile. We got from place to place by walking or maybe hitching up the mule to the wagon and going off. And so we were isolated enough that music was very important to us. We wanted something that would dispel the loneliness and bring us a little relief. And it was particularly good for my mother. You know, she never lacked living on the farm.
No.
No way can romanticize that existence. And it was a hard work for her. Not only did she work in the house, in the kitchen, and doing whatever was needed there, she'd also go out to the fields, pick cotton and chop cotton, do whatever was necessary. So she lived and died by the radio. But she also sang as she worked. And we could always tell when she was worried about something or she'd suffering from some slight, you know, that she suffered from my father. And she would break into a song. If the world from you withhold of its silver and its gold, and you have to get along on meager fare, just remember in his word how he fed the little bird. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. Leave it there. Oh, leave it there. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. If you trust and never doubt, He will surely bring you out. Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there. I didn't learn until many years later that was written by an African-American composer named Charles Tindley, who had a church in Philadelphia at the early years of the 20th century. And he wrote a lot of songs that moved beyond his church, out into the hinterland, became the possession of both white and black people. And I think anybody who was poor and isolated and suffering could find release in that song.
It's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful song.
And my earliest memories are of her singing. Certainly the first country music I ever heard was the songs that my mother sang. Mm. Not only old gospel songs like that, but old parlor songs, sentimental songs from an earlier age. And I don't know where she learned them, because they must have been learned before we got a radio. And my older brothers, they got a guitar, I guess, around 1942, 43, I learned from them with our mother's encouragement. That's one thing that always held the family together.
And so the family is three boys and
two older brothers.
And so it is always lucky to be the youngest in your family, because you get all the musical legacy.
And I had the easiest job, too. The older brothers, they were the ones that had to go out in the fields and work, and I was left around the house.
You weren't the water boy?
Yeah, I would do that, or I would take lunch to my daddy out in the field. And I did a little bit of farm work, but we left when I was about 10 years old, and so I escaped the greatest burden of it.
That is an escape. It's true. Mm-hmm. And you all moved to sort of a community, a more urban community, not that far away, huh?
About 20, 25 miles away. But it was might as well have been 100 miles, because we very seldom got to town. Daddy would go once or twice a year, you know, to get supplies for the farm year, overalls and farm utensils and things like that, lard and flour, the basic food stuff. Or he might go to town at Christmas time to get us a few presents. And the only time we ever had fruit was at Christmas time, you know. He'd bring it back home and we would celebrate.
Was that in Van?
It was in Tyler.
Tyler, Texas.
Van was the nearest little community, about 5 or 6 miles away.
From the farm.
But Tyler was the place where we moved to when we finally left the farm.
And so your folks were tenant farmers, right?
Life never changed very much from year to year, because you'd grow your cotton, and then you'd turn over at least half or more of the cotton to the landlord. If you were lucky, you might keep a couple of bales of cotton, and he'd get another one. But we ate well. We had a garden, and we had vegetables that we could eat every year. We had a hog that we could kill, chickens that we could also consume.
When you think about life there versus life in Tyler, can you talk about how your household sounded on the farm versus in Tyler? What did the house sound like every day when you woke up?
Daddy would turn the radio on, and that would wake me from my sleep, and I'd hear a fiddler or a string band or a singer. So that's how the house sounded. It rang with music.
Exactly.
Of one kind or another. Once we lived in Tyler, on the weekends we would go into town and wait for my father to get off work. At that time he was working for a wholesale grocery house, and we'd just go down to the candy kitchen, buy some broken up candy. And when my brother went into the Navy in 1943, went into the Navy Seabees, of course my mother worried about him all the time. And so we
During the war, yeah, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We'd go into town and put a nickel in the back when you could put nickels in jukeboxes. And that way she could think about her sailor boy and hope that he would make it back home.
I'm walking the floor over you. I can't sleep a wink, that is true. I'm hoping and I'm praying as my heart breaks right in two. Walking the floor over you. Oh, pick it out, Smitty.
How much did you all know about the performers who were, I guess, dominating radio back then?
In the beginning, we knew only what they might confess on radio.
Confess? Or
they just talk about themselves. Talk about their upcoming personal appearances, and they dedicate a song to their mama, for example. It was real homey type stuff. There was a long, enduring magazine called Country Song Roundup, giving a little bit of biographical information. The Dallas Morning News also had a young people's page, and they devoted that to songs. Someone would write in and say, does anybody know the words to the Little Rosewood Casket, for example? Some other reader then, by the next issue, they would have sent in the words.
The little rosewood casket sitting on a marble sand. That's a package of love letters written by my true love's hand. Will you go and get them, brother? Come sit down beside my bed. Lay your head up on my pillow, for my heart is almost dead.
It was an oral culture in one sense, but we also had some written resources.
Right, right.
Songs that were preserved from newspapers or from old ballads.
You know, but you also write that oftentimes musicians would reimagine those songs to some degree, right? Write new lyrics to them or perform them somewhat differently than the original published version might suggest.
There's a little rosewood casket resting on a marble stand with a for me tonight. I have often tried, but I could not, for the tears that fill my eyes.
When country music began, of course, first of all, it wasn't called country.
Right.
They didn't know really what to call it.
What did they call it?
Yeah. And each the record labels differed. Columbia label described the songs in its catalog as old familiar songs. And that was a good description because that's what they were. These were just songs or fragments of songs that people had known all their lives and learned from their parents or from some traveling musician. And so that was the repertoire of early music. And we called it hillbilly. Hillbilly was another term that had developed by 1925, and then it began to gain more currency as years went by. And the music wasn't described as country music until about 1949 or 1950.
Right, after the war.
Yeah.
But is it okay to use the word hillbilly today or no?
It's an in term. I don't know whether our listeners will have watched the Ken Burns documentary or not, but I suspect
music.
They probably would have. There was a great scene in the documentary featuring Dwight Yoakam. And Dwight, when Dwight started recording, he had a couple of songs that had hillbilly in the title. And his producer said, you can't use that word. That's unrespectful. And Dwight said, sure, that's what we were. We were proud of the term. We grew up with that. We thought it meant working class people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud to use it now. I don't mind using the word hillbilly at all because it just refers to that working class culture that I grew up in.
But at the same time, though, on the other side of the color line, you know, the music that people referred to by black artists in the South was, they used a term that's not necessarily aged well.
Yeah.
It was sort of an N-word term, you know, mm-hmm. N-word music, you know, and all. But which, again, has sort of an interesting evolution, that word, you know what I mean? Because some people use it, some people don't. Some mm-hmm. people feel very strongly about it, some people don't, you know. But in many ways, you know, Southern music, you know what I mean, sort of captures, you know, some of the most important contradictions and unifying elements of American culture.
Virtually every white country musician you can think of who exerted any kind of influence can point to an African-American influence or antecedent. The beginning is, of course, Jimmy Rogers borrowed the blues
mm-hmm.
and work songs like Mule Skinner Blues
right.
from African-Americans, sometimes from phonograph records, but sometimes from street musicians, and above all from African-American workers who worked for his father's railroad crew. And Jimmy was sometimes part of that as a little water boy. Hey, little water boy, bring that bucket round. If you don't like your job, throw that water bucket down. That came out of his life because he was a water boy for railroad crews that were principally African American.
Hey, little water boy, bring that water round. If you don't like your job, set that water bucket down.
In Meridian, right? Mm-hmm. Meridian, Mississippi.
And on the line from Meridian down to New Orleans.
Right.
They call them extra gangs. They were crews that went out to repair the roads. Bob Wills, the father
of Western
Swing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He loved the music of Bessie Smith and their African-American bands of the 20s and 30s. And then Hank Williams in the 40s, he learned much of what his guitar style from an African-American in Alabama, Rufus Payne, who was known by the name of T-Tight. He liked to spend his time with T-Tight and learning his songs. Of course, Elvis.
Elvis,
don't
of course.
Don't have to say anything about him. But he's,
you're right.
But just on and on. The African-American presence was so strong. So that was part of country music from the day that it was first commercialized.
For some reason, country music seems to have, or at least the industry, mm-hmm. seemed to have decided that this is white music.
And that decision you referred to was made as early as the 1920s.
Mm.
When the first hillbilly records were made, they were put into a special bin, a special category label. And black music was put into another. It's race records then, and the later R&B.
Right.
And overlooking the great common ground from which they came.
She come to the joint, a 44 in each hand. She said, stand aside, all you women and men, 'cause I'm looking for my man. Deodorly.
That's Jimmy Rogers and a then uncredited Louis Armstrong with Blue Yodel Number 9, Standing on the Corner. Coming up, how to be a cowboy and a man. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Our guest is Southern music historian Bill Malone. His life story parallels the evolution of country music from the Great Depression onward.
One of the greatest events in our life was the day that Daddy brought a Philco battery-powered radio into the house. This is in 1939. That really opened up a new world for us.
Back in East Texas, Malone grew up listening to Western-themed radio adventures, like the Lone Ranger.
The outlaws on the rim grew bolder when they saw that there was but one gun firing from the canyon floor. Then that gun, too, went silent.
And yet Malone may have been more partial to the singin'est cowboy of all. Gene Autry shared the code of how to be a cowboy and a man.
The first one's the welcome sign, written deep in Western hearts. My camp is your camp, and yours is mine in all cow country parks. Treat with respect all womanhood, same as you would your sister. Take care of neighbor's strays you find, and don't call cowboys mister. Shut the pasture gates when passing through, and take in all, be just as rough as you please, but never mean or small. Talk straight, shoot straight, and never break your word to man nor boss. Always kill a rattlesnake, and don't ride a sore-backed horse. It don't take law or pedigree to live the best you can. These few is all it takes to be a cowboy and a man.
On one hand, it seemed exciting and like another world. The musicians seemed exotic because they sang about cowboys and hobos and
ramblers.
Ramblers, bad men. And so you could try to put yourself in their shoes. And you also felt, though, that they were like cousins or brothers because they talked the same patter that you used. They seemed to understand your world.
Right.
And so I grew up thinking that although that was a supposedly exotic world they were singing about, it was a world that was not close to me. I felt, well, you know, if I learn a few chords on the guitar, if I really try hard, maybe I can sing on the radio someday too. And I think that's the role that country music played everywhere.
Absolutely.
Build a world of sort of a family. You know, you're one of us, and we're just like you.
But, you know, one of the points that you have made consistently over your career, Bill Malone, is that you talked about the importance of nostalgia in country music. You know, maybe a kind of romanticism that is based on sometimes reality, sometimes fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the music came from a culture that was undergoing great transformation, at least from the Civil War on, at least, and a culture that was under siege, it was looked down upon, and was sometimes with good reason. the rural South being the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan, let's say, you know, other things that don't like to emphasize, but you can't forget, you know. That beyond those blemishes, it was also a culture that could be very generous and hospitable and caring. So I think the musicians labored under those kind of sort of opposites. I realize that I got pretty quickly away from your question.
About nostalgia, that's yes. Right.
Yeah. It was a culture under great transformation. The nature of agriculture was changing. People were moving. They were moving from one part of the country to another. And then increasingly in the years of the 20th century, it was away from the farm into the towns and cities, into new occupations. But all that was traumatic, but it was memorable. And people couldn't forget the background, the past that they were leaving.
Right. And oftentimes wrote songs about that, mm-hmm. about
the old
leaving
home place.
Yeah, the old home place, leaving family, even family behind in mm-hmm. order to go and, you know, ostensibly, you know what I mean, make a living that can help the family back home. You know, and that seems to have, you know what I mean, been a trope in country music that has gone almost the length of country music.
And it wasn't confined just to rural people who were moving. It was a kind of an impulse that affected Americans as a whole. The recognition that theirs was a society once rural, but was becoming the most important urban industrial society in the world. So nostalgia wasn't an American trait.
Right.
And strongly capitalized on by writers and by country musicians.
Sure. And then even in more modern times, you know, Johnny Cash's Hey Porter, that's a guy trying to get home.
Hey Porter, would you tell me the time? How much longer will it be till we cross that Mason-Dixon line? At daylight, would you tell that engineer to slow it down? Or better still, just stop the train, because I want to look around.
Or Dolly Parton's song. What is it?
She has one called In My Tennessee Mountain Home. There's one.
Life is as peaceful as a baby's sigh. In my Tennessee mountain home, crickets sing in the fields nearby.
There are two very powerful impulses in country music. On one hand, there's the sanctification of home,
mm-hmm.
and all those great secure values it supposedly embodies. But there's the other side of the coin. That's the desire to get away from that existence. The ramble.
Keep on going down the line.
The rambler is quite often a person who is left home, but he wants to get back there if he can.
That's right,
and the songs about home. It's often about sitting there in your fireside, hearing the distant wail of a train over the next hill. Boy, I wish I was on that train and gone.
It's so it works, true.
They reinforce each other.
And so, who were your musical heroes as you were moving into college?
Hank Williams, for one. I was lucky enough to see him when I was about 14 years old.
He came
to Tyler with the cast of the Louisiana Hayride. The Louisiana Hayride is in Shreveport. They usually broadcast from the
municipal
auditorium.
Yeah.
But on occasion, they would go out into the Arklatex in Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma. And that particular night, it was from Tyler.
Mm.
Maybe a few months or a year before he left and went to the Grand Ole Opry.
So he was in his prime at that time. Although the man was, I mean, he was a very young man.
29 when he died.
Right, 29 when he died.
Hank Snow was a big favorite. A Canadian singer who I thought could do a little bit of everything. Great, great guitar picker. I remember getting a postcard from Ernest Tubb, which I still have.
Really?
Glad to have that in my possession.
You know, I think I might be the only person in America who did not know that Hank Williams married for the second time in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And sold tickets.
Yeah. I think they may have had two ceremonies. I think there was one before the Justice of the Peace and another on the stage.
On the stage.
And one of the ironic things about that union is his second wife was also married later to Johnny Harton, another country star. And he died young. He died in an automobile crash in East Texas. So she was left a widow twice.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my
country
goodness.
Stars.
And so can you, you know, I'm greedy. You know, I'm going to push you. You know, is there any particular song that you think of when you think about any of these gentlemen that you might be willing to share a little with us?
I wish I could do Lovesick Blues, but I can't do that yodel. That was Hank's ticket to the Grand Ole Opry. But I don't know, something like, Tonight down here in the valley, I'm lonesome and oh, how I feel. As I sit here alone in my cabin, I can see your mansion on the hill. Do you recall when we parted? The story to me you reveal. You said you had lived without love, dear, in your loveless mansion on the hill. The light shines bright from your window. The trees stand so silent and still. I know you're alone with your past love in in those lovely mansions on the hill. That supposedly was a song that he wrote on demand. It's probably just a story, probably not true at all. Hank went on from there to be at that time, I think, the greatest country writer in the world, and the poet of loneliness, they called him.
We're talking with historian Bill Malone. Coming up, what did Ralph Waldo Emerson know about country music? Don't go away.
These songs, they often sound like, and maybe you've already made this point, but I don't care. these songs, they often sound like songs that have always existed before even there was an America, before there was, you know what I mean, a Europe. You know, they seem like they were written in stone someplace.
Well, it's like the oversoul that Ralph Waldo Emerson talked about, you know. I guess there's just a big, great big melody and cluster of words out there somewhere that they all can tap into.
That's country music scholar Bill Malone, the singing historian. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. Here's another one of his favorites.
10 years ago, on a cold, dark night, there was someone killed 'neath the town hall light. There were people at the scene, and they all agreed that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me. The judge said, "Son, what is your alibi? You were somewhere else. You won't have to die." I spoke not a word, though it meant my life, for I had been in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks these hills in a long black veil. Visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. The scaffold was high and eternity near. She stood in the crowd, shed not one tear. But sometimes at night, when the cold winds moan, in a long black veil, she cries o'er my bone. She walks these hills in a long black veil, visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. First done by Lefty Frizzell, 1958. Then picked up by everybody.
Everybody. The band.
Joan Baez.
Joan Baez, mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, just a beautiful, beautiful song. I wanted to ask you, Professor Malone, you took up the study of country music formally in college when you were at the University of Texas at Austin. Is that correct?
But it was my dissertation, though. The study came about accidentally.
How so?
I passed, got through all my courses, passed the prelims, and then it was time to choose a dissertation. Had no earthly idea what to do.
Well, what were the top ideas?
I thought perhaps doing something on Southern labor, And but everybody I knew was working on something that they didn't like.
But we're stuck
something
with.
Had been assigned to them, you know.
Yeah.
There actually were, literally were topics like abandoned short line railroads.
No.
Crude oil pipelines.
I'm falling asleep.
Yeah. My supervising professor, Joe Franz, was a business historian, among other things, you know. So he tended to put his students onto topics like that. But I, on the other hand, I was always singing.
Ah.
Singing around the department and at parties. And we started around 1959 or 60, we started going out to this bar in North Austin called Threadgill's. It was run by a fellow named Kenneth Threadgill, who was a singer and yodeler, a Jimmy Rogers disciple. I and some of my graduate student friends would go out and just sit around the big tables and sing. And we'd play for Mr. Threadgill, as I always called him, while he sang Jimmy Rogers songs.
So is this like an early hootenanny?
The term was sometimes, it wasn't used for that. More just like a picking and singing, more likely, in the country western style. And I remember the night that Janis Joplin came out for the first time with her friends. She was part of a group called the Waller Creek Boys.
So she came out to Threadgill's?
Uh-huh. She was an undergraduate at the University of Texas. Nobody had ever heard of Janis before that time, outside of her hometown of Port Arthur.
What did you think of her?
Powerful singer. She'd knock you over from the beginning. I have to honestly say I wasn't all that welcome to what she brought in, because I thought, well, here goes the neighborhood, you know. So getting back to the question, then it was time for me to find a dissertation. One weekend, my professor and I and a couple of other people drove down to Houston for the Blue Bonnet Bowl. You know, the Texas Longhorns were playing, I think, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sang all the way down. And just out of the blue, I think at dinner, Dr. Friend said, you know, you love that music so much. Why don't you write a history of Nashville publishing?
Mm.
Again, it was his business interest.
Right.
And I thought, you can do that? You can actually write on something you like? So I, of course, I embraced it immediately. But then once I got into the topic, I just went my own way. I decided to do just a general history of country music. Nothing like that had ever been done.
Which is amazing to me. And I would imagine to a lot of people, you know, given how pervasive country music was in this country and remains in this country, I mean, the fact that serious scholarship of it began with you in the late 1950s.
Mm-hmm. The dissertation was finished in 1965, and then it was published into the book Country Music USA in 68.
In 68, mm-hmm. and then republished in 1985, and then expanded yet again, and mm-hmm. now there's a 50th anniversary edition of this book, Country
Just
Music
a couple
USA.
Years ago. Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, did you feel as if you got any pushback within academia? In terms of this subject that people perhaps didn't think you were serious?
I got a lot of that from fellow graduate students and later from colleagues in the history departments. It's not a serious topic, you know. It's something you can enjoy, have fun doing on a Saturday night, maybe, but no serious scholar would write on this topic, you know.
Were they just jealous because they hated what they were studying and you looked like you liked yours?
There was actually was a graduate student who said to me one day, he said, you know, I really envy you. You're working on that topic. I'm writing on the history of the Austro-Sardinian War. And you're getting to write about all that music stuff. And even after I started teaching at Tulane, you know, there was still resistance. It was a tough time getting a full-time appointment.
Well,
and, of course, it had been a surprise to me just, I guess, how enduring the popularity of country music has been. There's been an explosion of writing on the subject, but still not all that much in my own discipline of history.
Well, how did you mentally and maybe even professionally combat this, you know, I mean, these sort of negative signs, you know, from your colleagues or from others who didn't think what you were doing was serious?
Well, I just plowed along and always in talks and lectures, whatever, I tried to emphasize the context in which the music evolved and explain how important it was to the history of the working class and to American cultural development. But of course, you use the word folk a lot. That's
vernacular music.
That's
folk,
right.
Yes.
Whatever
yes.
term seemed more respectable to
exactly.
folk, you know?
That's exactly
anything but hillbilly. Or
as you well know, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of spoils in academia. You're not making $1 million
right.
or anything like that. So, mm-hmm. you know, where are you getting approbation?
From singing helped a lot. I was always singing. I had a band in New Orleans called the Hill Country Ramblers, a bluegrass band that was named by my first wife, first ex-wife, as they say in country. So that's one way you deal with it. You just participate in it. You sing and rid yourself of anxiety and frustration in that way.
And then hopefully you live long enough to prove everybody wrong.
Here comes Ken Burns. The great validator.
The great validator. Yes, the great validator. You know, this was a significant series. It was, what, 16 hours?
Mm-hmm. A little over.
A little over 16 hours, sort of limbing the whole history of country music, which obviously could take a heck of a lot more than 16 hours to tell.
And the stories are so good.
Yeah. My first criticism of this program is that you're not in it enough, okay? And all. But then as I watch it, I realize, you know, they'd stolen every idea that you ever wrote about. You know, so you are in it, actually.
Yeah, I recognize a lot of my stuff.
Oh, boy, you really are there.
I think what happened was, you know, I was interviewed back in 2014.
Okay.
It was about a four-hour interview in New York City, and they just took excerpts from it throughout the documentary. I think what happened was they interviewed me as I was their only historian.
Yes.
But then they said, well, just let the musicians tell the story themselves for the most part. We don't need Bill Malone coming in all the time like, who was the fellow, the narrator in the Civil War?
Oh, sure. Like Shelby Foote.
Shelby Foote.
Yes, yes. Well, why not be Shelby Foote? I mean,
I would love to have been the Shelby Foote, but I think they did to find out that the story can be told by many people and not just one. People like Dolly Parton and Merle Haggard and Dwight Yoakam. They're very Marty Stewart, of course, who shows up again and again. Very articulate.
That's very true. But you know, there is a shift that happens in this series, where at the beginning there's a lot of talk about how Southern Americans were living and the changing times and all of that, and you provided a lot of context, you know what I mean, about what the listeners were doing and what they were about.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, over the 16 hours, you know what I mean, it gradually becomes a litany of stories about the performers. You know what I mean? And with less information about the listeners.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you. Particularly in the late 50s and 60s, there's a bigger story there that could be told.
Yes.
There was a great, as we all know, great cultural division in the United States then, as now. And they get into that a fair amount, but I think they could have told more, but
I think you could have, you know, and because, you know, they sort of skip over the civil rights movement and they go straight into Vietnam, you know what I mean, as the issue that really mm-hmm. rent a lot of people in country music or country music listeners, you know.
But folks like Charlie Pride did play a great role in breaking down racial barriers.
Right.
And just letting everybody know just what a big audience there was for it and where the music came from.
But just between you and me, I'm not so sure about it. 'Cause just between you and me, you're too much to forget. You're too much to forget.
But at the same time, there were little record labels in the South, like in Crowley, Louisiana, that were putting out very racist recordings. Mm. The Reb Rebel label was one of them.
Right.
Using words that...
tough language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tough language.
So that was there.
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're talking with country music historian Bill Malone. This country owes a great deal of gratitude to Ken Burns, you know, for his previous series that talk about all manner of American life. You know, can you talk a little bit about your experience with him?
I think he's our greatest public historian. And I'd always wondered why he hadn't tackled country music, because it's such an integral part of American life. And I believe someone in Texas, I don't know the identity, but a good friend of Ken Burns had mentioned that to him, said, why don't you do country music? So he got to thinking about it. Then he mentioned the subject to Dayton Duncan, one of his producers. And Duncan said, well, if you do it, I want to do it. I want to be the chief producer, which he was. I first saw the rough cuts of the show in 2017. My wife and I went to Walpole, New Hampshire, where Ken Burns has his barn, as he calls it, and his home. So we sat around and watched every segment, 2 hours at a time. And then once it was over, he'd go around the room and ask each person to give their critiques. And finally, when it was all over, after about 4 days, then he went around the room one more time and asked us to give our final evaluation. Even Dayton Duncan himself had been tearful at different times during the documentary, mainly because on screen you could see people who had passed on, people who had been interviewed, you know, like little Jimmy Dickens, for example, and Mel Tillis, and Merle Haggard, who had since died. And I think it was such respect, such reverence for what they had done. People just couldn't hold their emotions back, and that was true of me. In my final evaluation, you know, I thought of the fact that my mother had been the first person who introduced me to this music, who set me on the road that I've followed ever since. And I considered what Ken Burns had done to be a validation of my scholarship and a validation of the culture from which I came, the whole culture of country music. A music that had fought for recognition and respect as well as commercial success throughout its entire history. It was finally getting it from one of the premier cultural historians and icon himself in Ken Burns. So it was just a very emotional moment for me, and I just couldn't hold back the tears.
I'm so grateful to you that you were with us, Bill Malone. You've just been wonderful. And I don't know. I miss those classes where you would bring your guitar in and sing to the students. I wish more people did that.
Well, if I can remember a little bit of this one, and I'm not even sure what key it should be in, but I think it would be appropriate there. I never knew that the place I grew was the sweetest place on earth, till I roamed around from town to town. Now I know what it's worth. Come and listen to me while I sing my song about my little old home down in New Orleans. In the sunny south where the black oil flows, that's where I long to be. In the Dixieland where the white cotton grows, it's calling me, I know. And soon I'll be in the land of my dream, in my little old home down in New Orleans. Ole, ole. Let me see it. I've been east and way out west, been around most everywhere. Now I'm heading south for a big long rest. I'll be glad when I get there. All the wonderful things in the world, it seems, are waiting for me down in New Orleans. In the sunny south where the white cotton grows, that's where I long to be. In the sunny south where the black oil flows, it's calling me, I know. And soon I'll be in the land of the dream. It's my little old home down in New Orleans. Yodelay, yodelay, yodelay. Jimmy Rogers. I mean, I made up my own words two or three times there.
I don't think Mr. Rogers would mind so much. Bill C. Malone joined us. He is the author of Country Music USA, Don't Get Above Your Raisin, and all manner of great scholarship on country music. He joined us here at Oak Street Studios in New Orleans. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Margaret Howes, Lars Howell, Rick G. Nelson, and Justin Armstrong. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNL. For more information about Bill Malone, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to like us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.